Hello and welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. I'm Viv Davis, and today I'm talking to Angus Deaton, Professor of Economics and International Affairs at Princeton University, about his recent book titled The Great Escape: Health, Wealth, and the Origins of Inequality. Professor Deaton explains how inequality is the catalyst for the great escape from poverty and how the world is better because of it. We also discuss the state of inequality in the United States, economic growth in China and India, and the ineffectiveness of international aid. I began the interview by asking Angus to explain the background and motivation for writing the book.
I've always been interested in human well-being in one form or another. I might not have called it that or thought about it that way. You know, my early work was on consumption and savings and things like that. And then I got interested in health, and then I got interested in development. I came to believe that these were all part of the same thing, and that in order to think sensibly about progress in the world or progress for people, you had to think of these things all at the same time. And I think we've been too narrow with economists focusing on incomes and doctors focusing on health and philosophers thinking about it, and not really talking to each other in a way. And so the book is broad, but it's focused towards the progress of human well-being. I wanted to put that in ordinary words so that a fairly wide spectrum of people would have a chance to read it.
Okay, so in the preface to the book, you provide a really quite poetic image, if I may say so, that the book is about the endless dance between progress and inequality, and about how progress creates inequality, and inequality can sometimes be helpful and sometimes unhelpful.
Right.
Can you describe and explain that a little more?
Part of it is just this obvious thing, you know, if people broke out of a prison or war camp, they got free, and the people who got left behind got left behind. And so, you know, say, great, a lot of people got out of prison or war camp, but this great gap opened up. The great gap, in that case, doesn't seem like a huge thing, but people are inside and no worse off. And what's more is they see that it's not possible to escape, and they've learned how to forge the passports or whatever the people taught them about how to get out. So I think a lot of progress is like that, that people find a way of saving someone's life. You don't have to die of smallpox. You don't have to die of childhood leukemia or something. And then other people imitate that, and it moves up, and so those gaps are temporary gaps which incentivize the people left behind to catch up. And that's inequality playing a very positive role. I mean, another one in India today, people see, maybe on television, which has become quite widespread in India, they see that other people's kids have got jobs at call centers that are moving up in the world, or back office jobs. And they realize that their kids couldn't hold those jobs because they haven't been to school, so they start sending their kids to school. So you've got an inequality that's causing people to get educated and help closes the inequality and helps stimulate progress. But the other side, to take the prisoner of war analogy, is what happens to the people who escape think, well, we're staying out, but we're going to make sure those guys don't get out behind us and fill in the tunnels behind them or make sure that no one else gets up there. And there have been many, many examples of that throughout history. The people who made it are threatened by the people who are coming behind and decide to choke off their escape. That's often political. You see it in the United States today, where people who got rich in the healthcare industry or people who got rich in banking are lobbying the government to make sure they preserve their position.
I think you described it as pulling up the ladders.
Pulling up the ladders. And there were no ladders in the movie, of course, so I have to talk about filling in the tunnels. But pulling up the ladder seems better. So if you scramble up, pull up the ladder, no one else can follow.
I guess there are many different types of inequalities as well as different types of progress. How do you define them in the book, and how do you measure and value them?
I think there's bits of it that are very well understood, like the simple economist's concept of income inequality, for instance, and looking at something like a Gini coefficient for the whole country, which people do all the time. I think that has become richer more recently because we've realized that many different things are going on in different parts of the income distribution, and so looking at the whole pattern of incomes is very important. But there are also inequalities in health. You know, the nice thing about the movie analogy is this is an inequality in freedom, and that inequality in freedom is not in an easily measured dimension, but it's still obviously very important and sort of easily documented. One I think one might be interested in is inequalities, an obvious health inequality, which is that poor people smoke a lot more than rich people, for example. And that, you know, it used to be that physicians were among smoked as heavily as anybody else. And you got something like the Surgeon General's report in the United States, which seemed to stop that very quickly. The Surgeon General was smoking on the way to the press conference, puffing away on his cigarette. And one of his aides said, you know, as soon as you get in there, Dr. Terry, they're going to ask you whether you're a smoker or not. And he said, that's ridiculous. I refuse to permit such a question. That's about my personal life. This is about public health. And the aide said, well, I just told you, you know, it's not my fault. So, of course, the first question was to add, and Dr. Terry said, I don't smoke. And his questioner said, how long ago did you quit? And he said, 20 minutes. So, you know, you get an inequality because Dr. Terry, along with other physicians, quit really quickly, whereas poor, less educated, less well-informed people took a long time. And now they're still not doing it, or at least you've still got much higher smoking rates among poor people than rich people. So it's turned into a sort of durable inequality, which turns out to be very hard to get rid of. So that's another sort of inequality, a health inequality, rather than an income inequality.
And so you also discuss in your book the state of inequality in the US, as well as looking at economic growth in China and in India.
One of the things that's scary about the US is the way that economic growth has slowed down at the same time that inequality has increased. Because with slower economic growth, everything becomes really much harder, because if the pie is expanding, you can give everybody extra slices without anyone losing anything. Whereas when the pie is not expanding, the inequality becomes much more sharper and much more difficult to deal with, because I can only get something more if you get something less. And so a situation in which there was no conflict between us becomes one where there is conflict. And I think that's poisoning a lot of what's going on. It's happening not just in the US, but in other rich countries around the world. In China and India, you're getting sort of the opposite, which is great economic growth. There's been a lot of inequality in China, some of it artificial, I think, because people are not allowed to migrate from the countryside to the cities. So the people who live in the cities are doing terrifically well, and the people left behind artificially not. In India, there's been some increase in inequality, but maybe not as much, but a great deal of economic growth, and that growth is terrific. It's eliminating a lot of poverty, and it's narrowing income inequality around the world.
And in terms of international development, you suggest in the book that international aid isn't working. What can we do about redressing the imbalances, the economic imbalances between rich and poor countries?
Well, first of all, I should say I think there's a tremendous moral obligation on all of us who've made the Great Escape to look back and help those behind us, not pull up the ladders behind us. So we should be doing something about this. That's point one. Point two is I think the aid that I'm negative about is the aid in which involves us spending money in other people's countries, which is trying to develop other people's countries from the outside, using money as the primary instrument. I'm not sure that's feasible to make things better by doing that. But there's lots of things we can do. And some of the things we can do is we can give aid for countries without giving aid in countries. And the most obvious of those are, for instance, one of the greatest gifts that the First World has given to what used to be called the Third World is basic science discoveries, for example, in medicine, the germ theory of disease, the fact that smoking causes cancer. We could do a lot more research, given our pharmaceutical companies, our scientific knowledge, that would generate cures and drugs that would treat diseases that are not very well treated now and that occur mostly in the poor world. So I think we could do a lot of that. I think we could stop trying to sell arms to poor countries all over the world, which is, I don't know why, what we think we're doing when we're giving foreign aid on the one hand and selling them arms on the other hand. We have a lot of trade policies like cotton subsidies or sugar subsidies in the United States, which are making life really hard for African farmers who could otherwise get ahead and are prevented from getting ahead because the world price of their crops are artificially low because the American government is pouring money into cotton subsidies in the U.S. So there's a lot of those things I'm entirely in favor of, and I think we could really help people. I think the World Bank has a huge amount of knowledge about what's happened as people try to develop around the world. And that knowledge, it ought to be turned into a big consulting house that's selling that knowledge. I think it ought to compete with McKinsey or with DFID or with other places that do the same thing. But all of that, I think, would be tremendously useful. What I worry about is countries, particularly in Africa, where almost all the revenue that's coming in to the government is coming from aid agencies. And so these governments have no incentives to develop an appropriate contract with their own people,
sure,
in which there's this sort of exchange of taxes on the one hand for government services. The government is missing in action in a lot of poor countries, and that makes poor people's lives impossibly difficult. You can't start a business, you don't get proper schooling, you don't get proper health care, and you've got to have better government, and aid tends to undermine that. And so, especially in places where it's a very large chunk of the economy. And that means a lot of poor countries in Africa and a few other countries around the world.
So what do you see as the prospects for the future of the planet? Is it a world of perfect equality, or is there a limit to progress? Or will this dance between progress and inequality simply continue, but on a higher turn of the spiral?
I don't think there's ever going to be a world of complete equality, because we're not built that way. You need some inequality to incentivize people to do stuff. If everybody earned exactly the same, no one would do any work. That would be not a very attractive or useful world. On the other hand, I think there are great threats out there, the most obvious of which is global warming. There are political threats all the time. I mean, you think of what might happen in China if economic growth suddenly stopped, and a government that has no real deep popular support loses what's keeping it in power, which is the delivery of ever-expanding consumer goods to the people. You worry about the extreme inequality in the United States and its corrosive effect on government, and that could, you know, bring down the U.S. and bring down a lot of the world financial system with it. I mean, the U.S. sort of did that in 2008, and it could be worse. But, you know, I think human ingenuity, the desire to do better for yourself and for your children, is very, very powerful. And I think that will find the way out again and again and again.
There'll always be those who want to escape.
There will always be those who want to escape.
So finally, Angus, I know it's very difficult because the breadth of the book is so great, but if there was one policy message or one message that you'd like to convey to policymakers from this book, what do you think it might be?
The single most powerful one, and it's taken me a long time to come to this in my life, is just understanding that you have to look at human well-being holistically. You can't just look at health or have one set of people, like doctors, look at health. A lot of economists worry about income. Or if economists worry about income, not think about health or not worry about democracy. I mean, China's done pretty well on health improvement, especially recently, and has done pretty well in economic growth, but the place is not a democracy, and that has to count against what they've done. So you have to look holistically, and you have to think about all those things together if you're going to take a sensible view of human well-being, and those policies have to incorporate that. But I think that's very, very important. And I also think you just can't let inequality look after itself. That inequality could often be helpful, but it sometimes could be a terrible threat.
Angus Stephen, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you.